All right, so I think it was almost 12 years ago, I was wrong. And there was a laugh like that wasn't the only time. But I'd asked a group at the feast, it was probably around 150 people in the room, it was a seminar, and I asked them a question, actually a series of questions. I want to ask you the same questions. And I've already stated I was wrong in my answer, so it's okay to be wrong. How many of you think Christ is going to return, just raise your hand and hold it there, in the next 500 years? That there's a high probability of that. Next 500 years. Okay. Leave your hand up until you don't like the number I threw out. How about the next 100 years? High probability that Christ will return in the next 100 years. Okay, let the record show. This is a smaller group, but let the record show, I would say 90%+ still has their hands up. One in the back is really shaking hard. He doesn't think so. All right, now, okay, and back 12 years ago, maybe half the room had their hand up at this point. Then I asked, how about within the next 10 years? Oh, now there's some hands going down. I still think, and I did back then, that there's a high probability of Christ coming back within the next 10 years. I was wrong more than 10 years ago. And so was all the others, because at that time, there was about 20% of the room that left their hands up, which I found it interesting. I've been thinking about this quite a bit recently. I wasn't surprised, nor do I think the others were, that we were wrong about Christ coming back in those 10 years that we talked about back then. And why shouldn't we feel not be surprised that we're wrong? It's because Christ made it very clear. No one knows, no man knows the day or the hour. But we should know the season. He makes that very plain. We're going to come back to this in a few minutes. Steve didn't step on any of my scriptures, but I think the passage that he brought up ties in with this pretty good. Let's go to Exodus 16. God, through Moses, is teaching the Israelites the concept of treating the sixth day as a preparation day for the Sabbath. We're going to spend a few minutes on this. In Exodus 16, verse 22, it says, on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much food, two omers apiece, when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses. And he said to them, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil, and all that is left over put aside to be kept until morning. God has just offered manna to the Israelites. They're complaining about lack of food. And so now he's offered manna to the Israelites. They can go out in the morning, they can collect it. But what we're going to focus on is the lesson of preparing all that we can, either on or by the sixth day, so that there can be rest on the seventh day. In verse 23, it says, bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil, and all that is left over put aside to be kept until morning. So we get a little bit of a hint there that even though this is probably very specifically talking about manna, why can't we take it for more of what it's really talking about? It says, bake what you want to bake. Boil what you want to boil on the sixth day. Why shouldn't we consider that the sixth day we should be preparing food for the seventh day? rather than waiting till the seventh day when the Sabbath at sundown comes around, and we start preparing this huge elaborate meal or maybe multiple meals for the Sabbath? Is there anything we can do on the sixth day to alleviate a lot of that work? Let's go over to Genesis 2 and verse 1. It says, "Thus the heavens and the earth were finished in all their multitude. And on the seventh day, God finished the work that he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work that he had done. So God blessed the seventh day, he hallowed it, because on it, God rested from all the work that he had done in creation." Steve just brought up to the kids a hobby. There's something that they like to do. Think about the last time you did a project. Doesn't matter what kind of project. Maybe it was cleaning out the garage or the basement. Maybe you decide to sit down and draw or paint a picture. Write a story. Maybe you finished a piece of woodworking or some metal fabrication. Maybe you went out and washed and waxed the car. What happens when we're done doing those types of tasks? We get done, and we stop. Sometimes because, whew, that was hard work. But just as importantly, we stop to admire our work, to consider our work, and how we might abide with that work. If I just finished washing the car, I'm considering, man, that really looks good. How am I going to keep it this way for more than a couple of minutes? God did the same thing. On the seventh day of creation week, he decided to sanctify the seventh day so that he and his creation would go through that process every seventh day indefinitely. He wanted to step back, rest from the work, admire his work, and abide with his work. If you think about it, Adam and Eve, that very first Sabbath, they'd just been created the day before. They're less than 24 hours new. And it's the very next day that God wants to abide with them. And if you think about it, because they're less than a day new, I don't know if old is the right term. But the long conversation between God and Adam and Eve had just barely started on how this life works. It wasn't just for them. It was for all life. Because God had put on their shoulders to be stewards over all of his creation. And on the seventh day, he wants to abide with them, spend time with them, interact with them, share with them. You've heard me ponder that the fall, along with God placing animal skins on Adam and Eve, for me makes sense that it took place on the 14th day of the first month of the first year. It wasn't called Passover, but to me, what took place that day falls in line with what took place as what we know as Passover. That would have been, if my thought process has any ability of being right, on the 14th day of the month, that would have been the second Sabbath. And that second Sabbath, we find Adam and Eve not necessarily seeking out God in the moment. They decide to go off and do as they pleased. Remember, God called out to them. Genesis 3 and verse 8. And they heard the sound of God walking up and down in the garden at the breeze, in the cool of the day. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the face of God in the midst of the trees in the garden. And God called to the man and he said to him, "Where are you?" And Adam answers and he says, "I heard you walking in the garden and I became afraid because I'm naked, so we hid ourselves." Have you ever considered that Adam and Eve could always know or find God just by listening? How often do we take time to just listen? How often do we consider that God always knew where they were at? The only reason he called out to Adam was to have him come out of their so-called hiding place. They weren't hidden. He called out to come out of their hiding despite their shame. Let's continue on how God unpacks the sixth day. In Exodus 16, verse 24. So they put it aside until morning, as Moses commanded them, and it did not become foul, and there were no worms in it. Again, now we're back to talking about the manna. And they'd been told that you could go out in the morning, the rest of the week, and you could collect the amount that you needed for your family, and there was a specific amount suggested. But if you ended up with excess, more than what you were going to eat over the next 24 hours, it was going to rot on you. It was going to degrade so that it was unedible, and worms would probably infest it. In verse 25, Moses says, "Eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field." So now he's talking about the seventh day, the Sabbath. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none. So don't go out looking for it. It's not going to be there. On the sixth day, go find it and gather more than you typically do. However, in verse 27, on the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather and they found none. They went off, instead of pursuing God, to pursue something they wanted. Do we remember that to go find manna, they had to leave the camp? It didn't fall right at the front of their tent door. They had to literally walk out of camp, and if we're talking about several million people, they had to walk quite a distance before they're out to the fields or the area where manna could have been found. During times of worship for the Israelites and times when they were called to gather as an assembly, most of the time, they would stay at their tent door and look towards the tent of meeting. And at times, God would command them to come out to the tent of meeting, which was outside of the gate, outside of the camp, a distance away. So when these that decided to go out looking for manna on the seventh day, they went out of the camp, but they didn't go the direction of the tent of meeting. They went the opposite direction. In a sense, they turned their backs towards God instead of looking towards his face, just as Adam and Eve had did in the garden on that seventh day. Verse 28. The Lord said to Moses, "How long will you refuse to keep my commandments and instructions? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you food for 2 days. Each of you stay where you are. Do not leave your place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day. It should be clear by now, God's making it very clear. He did not want his people to go out and gather on the Sabbath, to pursue their own desires, in a sense. He also makes it very clear that on the sixth day, it should be a day of preparation towards the Sabbath. Do what you need to do on or before the sixth day, so that the seventh day you can truly follow God's instructions. Gather what you will need for the Sabbath so that you can rest on the Sabbath. It wasn't only manna, because we find out that firewood also was not to be gathered on the Sabbath. You could have your fire, but you better make sure you have all the firewood you need by the day of preparation. Numbers 15, verse 32. When the Israelites were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. Those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses, Aaron, and to the whole congregation. They put him in custody because it was not clear what should be done to him. Then the Lord said to Moses, "The man shall be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him outside of the camp." The whole congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. It's not always explicitly noted in Scripture, but it should become clear that gathering what you needed for the Sabbath was to be done on or by the sixth day, not on the Sabbath. Nehemiah encountered a similar situation while helping to rebuild Jerusalem. In Nehemiah 13, verse 15, "In those days I saw in Judah people treading wine presses on the Sabbath and bringing in heaps of grain and loading them on donkeys, and also wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of burdens which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them at that time against selling food. Tyrians also who lived in the city brought in fish and all kinds of merchandise and sold them on the Sabbath to the people of Judah and in Jerusalem. Then I remonstrated with the nobles of Judah and said to them, 'What is this evil thing that you are doing, profaning the Sabbath day? Did not your ancestors act in this way, and did not our God bring all this disaster on us and on this city? Yet you bring more wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath.'" You hear what he says there. He says, "Did not our God bring all this disaster on us and this city?" The city's in ruins. Why? Because the people stopped following God's commands. And now they want to rebuild it, but still hang on to what ruined it. Verse 19 says, "When it began to be dark at the gates of Jerusalem before the Sabbath," so the sixth day, as the sun is starting to set, "I commanded that the doors should be shut and gave orders that they should not be opened until after the Sabbath. And I set some of my servants over the gates to prevent any burden from being brought in on the Sabbath day. If you read that passage again, there's another element in here. We were to gather what needed to be gathered for the Sabbath, but now the concept of merchandising gets brought in. We're not to be buying and selling on the Sabbath. Today, we have grocery stores on almost every corner. We have gas stations on almost every corner. It's very easy for us to realize, tomorrow I'm going to be on the Sabbath, I'm going to need to do some traveling, fill up the gas tank. There should be no reason to stop on the Sabbath to get gas when you could have bought that same gas on the sixth day. These accounts that we've been reading build on the foundation by mandating preparation for the Sabbath rest. In the gospel accounts, the day of preparation is revisited not only for the seventh day, but also for the high feast days. It's notated in the gospels that Christ's body had to be removed or taken down prior to the feast day starting. It's in Luke 23 and verse 54. It was the day of preparation and the Sabbath was beginning. And the women who had come with him from Galilee followed, and they saw the tomb and how his body was laid. Then they returned and prepared spices and ointments on the Sabbath. They rested according to the commandment. And if you read through each of the four gospel accounts, you'll see that there's actually two Sabbaths there. Reason being, because there was a high Sabbath day, a holy day, the first day of unleavened bread. And then there was a weekly Sabbath that falls during the time periods it's being written about. Whether it's the seventh-day Sabbath or a high day, the day prior is a day of preparation. By the end of that preparation day, we should have everything in our possession we need to enter and honor the seventh day. Today is the seventh day, a day that God wants to abide with us. He wants to spend time with us, you and I. He doesn't want us distracted by a bunch of other things. We're still going to be distracted. But do we do everything we can on the day of preparation so that the distractions are as minimal as possible? So yesterday, being the sixth day, we should have gathered all we need to celebrate the Sabbath in rest. We should have gassed up our vehicles. We should have planned for and purchased any food, prepared as much of it as possible in advance of the Sabbath. We should have purchased anything that we might need or think we would need through the Sabbath, so that there'd be no temptation of merchandising on the Sabbath. We can have our clothes ready for Sabbath. Should we be washing and drying our clothes on the Sabbath? Is it something that can be done the day prior? Probably. What about dishes? Could those wait until sometime other than the Sabbath? Now, all of a sudden, when we choose to utilize the preparation day, we have some extra time to truly rest, reflect. Maybe that's a good time to take a walk out in nature. Maybe some of that time is a good time to spend in conversation with other believers. When what was the Flint congregation started meeting with us, why, I heard on a regular basis about their Saturday morning video chat. I don't remember, what was that called? But a group of them would get together every Saturday morning and spend, what, an hour or so? Yeah. Just chit-chatting about their week, you know, while they got breakfast or something like that around. You could do something like that. You can do a mini Bible study on something. Sometimes a lot of us during the week are going too many different directions, and it's hard to find time to just sit down and study a very particular subject for a little bit. Maybe it's time to look up a word or a passage that's been in the back of your mind all week long. You heard it, and it's like, I wonder about this. Go look it up now. Maybe it's a good time to go to God about something that you'd like better understanding in, more knowledge in, more wisdom in. Maybe it's time to go to God about something that's been bothering you, being open and honest with Him. And again, turning into that mode where you listen also for His response to you. Because on the seventh day, we should not simply be seeking Him, but we should be facing Him. We should be worshiping Him in all that we say and do. So we spent some time talking about how to better utilize the sixth day of the week as preparation for the seventh day, Sabbath. We've been focused on just 7 days of the whole week on the calendar. Now let's zoom out. Let's look at a bigger picture of the calendar. Are we not living in the sixth day of the week when it comes to millennia? Second Peter 3 and verse 7. It says, by the same word, the present heavens and earth have been reserved for fire, being kept until the day of judgment and destruction of the godliness. But do not ignore this one fact, beloved, that with the Lord, one day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years are like one day. The Lord is not slow about his promise, as some think of slowness, but is patient with you, not wanting any to perish, but to all to come to repentance. But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, and then the heavens will pass away with a loud noise, and the elements will be dissolved with fire, and the earth and everything that is done on it will be disclosed. It's been more than 6,000 years since Adam and Eve were created from dirt and a rib. We are somewhere within the sixth day or the preparation day. Matthew 6:33, Christ said, but strive first for the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. The word seek there does not mean, absolutely does not mean, to casually wait. We're to be proactive. It's an action word. We're to pursue it, to prepare for it, the kingdom. Peter continues on with a question for us as the return of Christ draws near. 2 Peter 3 and verse 11. Since all these things are to be dissolved in this way, what sort of persons ought you to be in leading lives of holiness and godliness? Waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be set ablaze and dissolved, and the elements will melt with fire. Are we preparing for Christ's return? Will you be found as prepared for Christ's return? So how should we, could we, go about this time of preparation for Christ's return? In Matthew 24, Christ gives great insight as to the end of the age. And then in chapter 25, Christ gives a couple of parables as to his expectation of us preparing for his return. There's the parable of the 10 virgins and the lamp oil. 5 show up with their lamps full, enough oil. 5 of them show up with nowhere near enough oil. And they think at the last second they can just run out and buy more oil and all will be good. And they miss out. After that parable, it comes the parable of the talents. And that's followed by a glimpse of the final judgment. So let's consider the parable of the talents. If you remember, one of the servants was given 5 talents to steward over by the master. Steward. That's the same task that Adam and Eve were given over all of creation. It means to protect and grow, not simply watch and hopefully not harm. It means protect and grow. Matthew 25 and verse 15, to the one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, to each according to his ability, then he went away. The one who had received the 5 talents went off at once and traded with them and made 5 more talents. This parable and what follows, talking about the final judgment, brings up 3 areas that we can focus on in preparation for Christ's return. The first one, know your strengths and weaknesses, your ability and or your lack of ability. Seek opportunities from God to hone, sharpen your skills along with confidence. So the one servant that was given 5 talents, it says, at once he went off and traded. At once. He knew what he was doing. He had experience, he had knowledge, he had confidence. And he immediately went and put all of that to work. Now, the one who received 2, it doesn't say immediately, but it does say he also went off and traded for 2 more. Maybe that's a little bit more like you and I. We understand we're lacking in a little bit of confidence because maybe we don't have as much knowledge. Maybe we don't have as much experience. But we're willing. We're willing to put forth the effort that is needed to protect and grow what was placed in our hand. Maybe that servant, before he could go off and actually trade, maybe he had to knock on a couple of doors, call up a couple of friends, and say, hey, I have this opportunity, but I'm a little bit uncertain what I need to do about it. You got any insight for me? Maybe you had to jump on YouTube and say, hey, what's the best way to go about get a little bit more education? But after just a little bit of that, he said, you know what? I think I know enough. I'm going to go out and try this now. And he succeeded. Matthew 25 and verse 18. But the one who received the 1 talent went off and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. What was going through his head? Why did he give this to me? I've never done this before. It's going to take too much work. I don't have time for it. I don't like selling or negotiating. This is just going to turn out bad. Any or all of that could have been somewhat true. But he still had the opportunity to turn and ask a couple of questions to somebody, anybody. And at minimum, right away, he probably would have been hit with the knowledge of just take it down to the bank, put it in savings, and you're going to earn a little bit of interest. Wouldn't even do that. Because when the master returns in verse 27, you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and on my return I would have received what was mine with interest. Sadly, there's too many out there, and hopefully we're not one of them. They're just simply waiting for Christ's return rather than preparing for it. As we wait, we should be honing our skills and our God-given abilities, multiplying them, strengthening them, building our confidence to the point where we ask God, our Master, Father, would you give me a new opportunity today, a bigger opportunity? And especially in those areas where I'm lacking. Second thing we can glean from these parables, we should be strengthening our relationship with the Master, with God. The first servant immediately went off to complete the task. His goal wasn't to simply check off a box. Oh, the boss told me I gotta go do this today. Okay, fine, I'll go do it. That's not what he did. He went off to do exactly what the master intended him to do, not simply wanted him to do. He'd spent time with the master. He'd gained insight during that time as to why the task had been given to him. He understand he had some grasp of concept as to the household finances, in a sense, the business finances. I was listening to a podcast this week that talked about there's two things you got to keep track in business. Making money and saving money. You can make a lot of money, but if you don't know how to save money, it's all going to go away. So you got to watch the expenses. And this servant understood how to keep the whole system running smoothly. He'd asked enough questions over time, and he had insight as to how the master would have completed this exact same task. Probably right down to knowing, oh, I need to go see this banker over here. Not that one. Because that one is going to take advantage of me. He had a relationship with the master that matured over time. He knew who the master liked to do business with and who he didn't like to do business with. Maybe he had accompanied the master and had been introduced to influential individuals over time. And now those individuals treated the servant almost as well as the master. When they saw him walk in the door, they greeted him warmly, wanting to do business with him. Right now, you and I should be conversing with God and reading his word throughout our day so that we're on the same page with him at every turn. That doesn't mean we have all the experience, all the knowledge. We just know what his true will is. Are willing to walk through the steps it takes to complete that will. This third servant, he says, I knew you to be a hard man. That's the only thing he knew about his master. I knew you to be hard. That servant had no insight as to what was going on, did not want any insight as to what was going on. He just didn't want to get into trouble again because he'd already been in trouble with the master. That was his only motivation. I just don't want to get in trouble. But the master, in verse 30, as for this worthless slave, throw him into the outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. If we're not willing to prepare and act on our abilities that are God-given, we're useless. We're worthless. And we'll be destroyed. Third area where we can be preparing for Christ's return is to help others prepare for Christ's return. In 25 verse 34, Matthew. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you gave me clothing. I was sick and you took care of me. I was in prison and you visited me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when was it that we saw you and hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it that we saw you as a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it that we saw you sick or in prison and visited you? And the king will answer them, truly I tell you, just as you did it to one of the least of these who were members of my family, you did it to me. So back to this third servant, worthless servant. He's given one talent to steward over. And he decides to go bury it in the ground. He doesn't know when the servant or when the master's returning. So what's he doing? Nothing of worthwhile. He's waiting for his master's return, but he's doing nothing. Because in verse 34 it says, you that are blessed by my Father inherit the kingdom prepared for you. For when I was hungry, you gave me food. What would have happened if that servant with the one talent, not knowing what to do with the one talent, would have at least went out and started caring for others? When the master returned, he could have at least said, I still have your talent. I didn't make anything on it. While you were gone, I found out that the neighbor, their lawnmower broke down. So I went over and mowed their lawn for the last few weeks. I found out Mrs. Smith's car broke down. She had quite a few doctor's appointments. So I took her to all of her doctor's appointments. If he was able to just tell and show the master that, would there have still been weeping and gnashing of teeth? I don't think so. The first servant, with his confidence, his experience, and his zeal, was able to go off and very quickly take care of the task. He didn't know how long the master was going to be gone, and he had time. And I think he utilized that time to devote to helping others. The second servant, maybe he had to spend a little bit more time figuring out the best way to go about his task. But when he was done with that, he still had confidence. He knew how to take care of others around him, show love towards others around him. He interacted with individuals. A couple weeks ago, I went into a tool rental place and was getting a machine. While the lady was waiting on me, head popped out the door and said, "Hey, Aaron, how you been?" I looked up. It was a guy I'd known from years ago, used to work at Carter Lumber. And we chatted for just a couple seconds, and she's now back to the girl that was waiting on me. We're doing finishing up the paperwork, and Al turns to her and says, "Remember, I'm not here tomorrow. I got my wife's surgery." And I heard that. I got the machine and the paperwork all done, and his office was just kind of around the corner. And he'd went back into it, and he was on the phone. I wanted to go in and say something to him, but the next morning I returned the piece of equipment, which was the day of surgery. And it wasn't morning; it was later in the afternoon. And I asked the girl, same girl that waited on me the day before. I asked her. I said, "Hey, did anybody happen to hear from Al? Did things go well for his wife?" Al walks out of his office. He says, "Yeah, they did." And I said, "Well, I wanted to say something to you yesterday, but I said I prayed that things would go well for her and hope they will." He didn't tell me what kind of surgery she had. And he says, "Aaron, I really appreciate that." It's just little things like that. We don't have to spend a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money. But do we look for opportunities to care for everyone around us? And I mean everyone. Because we're supposed to love our enemies too. But the third servant, he stayed in his own little world. He didn't want to interact with anybody, even the master. That third servant, if he spends any time around anybody, it's only with those that will tolerate his complacency. We need to get out of our comfort zones instead of retracting further into our own shells. And each of us do that from time to time. But realize that when we do it and say, "You know what? I got to get up off my butt and do something." We don't know if we have a few years or a few decades left. Maybe a few centuries left before Christ's return. But we are in the day of preparation. Are we going to be found on the seventh day as the first or second servant? When Christ returns, he's going to know what we did on the preparation day. How will we be found? As one who pursued the kingdom in relationship with the master and all the while encouraging others? Or like the third servant that couldn't be bothered with any of that? Will we be found in the sixth day gathering, seeking everything that we're going to need to enter in the seventh day, the millennium. Do we even understand the task, opportunity that lies before us in that seventh day? Are we going to be a sheep on the right or a goat on the left? Matthew 25, verse 41. Then he will say to those on his left, "You that are accursed, depart from me into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels." Again, we don't know the day or hour, but we know the seasons. Over 6,300 years have passed. Has it been 690 or 6,990? I don't know. We don't know. But we're in that 6,000th year. We still have time to draw closer to the Master so we can better do his will and not neglect others around us as we do it. Because one day we do hope to hear Matthew 25, verse 21. And his Lord said unto him, "Well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a few things. I will set thee over many things. Enter into the joy of thy Lord." Joy. Joy. That's not stress. It's not intimidation. It's not worry. It's not work. It's the rest that comes with abiding in God.